Kia ora and welcome to Sobriety Chat. I am your host, Lotta Dan, otherwise known as Mrs. D. I am the community manager and content creator at livingsober.org.nz. And I am joined today by the very powerful and inspirational, no pressure, Richie Hardcore. Richie is an educator, he's a speaker and activist, he works in family and sexual violence prevention and men's mental health. He's also a former Muay Thai champion, coach and personal trainer, and he is sober. Welcome, Richie.
Yo, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to see you. Thank you for joining me on this Friday afternoon.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's a great day, so I'm primed for a good conversation full of vitamin
Always
D.
A good day to talk about living without alcohol.
Yeah, I think so too.
That's my favorite topic.
Evidently, you've made a life of it.
Exactly. I'm also about to start a university course, and it's like all these topics that are new to me, and so doing this work is like getting in a warm bath because it's my easy favorite topic.
Oh, cool. What are you doing at university?
Counseling, believe it or not.
Oh yeah, I do believe it. I think that's a pretty logical segue from what you're doing now, right? Like, I imagine a lot of people get in touch with you asking you for advice. Where do I get help? Who can I talk to about my drinking?
I've got very clear boundaries at the moment around the fact that I'm not a trained professional. So what I do is peer support. That's what Living Sober is all about, peer support. Yeah. Yeah. But I'm also looking at my life and thinking, you know, I've got 20 more years of work. What's my career going to be? And so I figure if I do this training now, then I've got something I can fall back on. Richie, this is not meant to be about me, okay?
Oh, no, I'm cool with it. I'm the same. Like, people message me pretty, you know, every week. Most days about where can I get help with my drinking or my partner's drug use or my mental health. So I fully resonate with what you're talking about.
Right. So let's talk about that. So first of all, you are perhaps a little bit different from the normal guests that I would have on, in that your story isn't so much that you were drinking to the point where you really needed to quit and then became sober. Am I correct? Or at least tell us, what is your sort of story with alcohol? Were you ever a big drinker, or what's led you to be the person you are today with alcohol?
Yeah, I grew up with an alcoholic dad. So my dad's he's in recovery at the moment. But my childhood was really tumultuous because of my father's own struggles with mental health, and because he dealt with that through chronic alcohol use. And that goes back through, like, my fucker papa. Apparently my grandfather was a heavy drinker. My great grandfather on that side of the family came back from World War One. You know, we would imagine very traumatized from what he'd experienced, and that, you know, travel down the family line, right? Which is common of, I guess, a lot of us who have been affected by either our own struggles with substances or other people's. So I always had a real aversion to drinking, I suppose. So when I got into, like, my adolescence, about 15, and my friends started drinking and using drugs, I kind of had like a knee-jerk reaction against it. And strangely enough, I had also the willpower to be like, nah, bro, I don't want to get hammered. I'd been doing martial arts for a couple of years, and I really think that gave me a lot of the self-esteem required to reject peer pressure to some degree. And to my dad's credit, like, my dad had taken me to the local community hall and told the instructor, hey, I'm not doing the best job as a dad. Can you help out my son? Because I, you know, I was not a particularly confident young person. In fact, confidence is a relatively new thing that I've developed. But yeah, that kind of gave me the ability to, I guess, reject what all my homies were up to. And because I grew up with, like, chaos, I always hung out with, like, the extreme ends of people, like, whether that were my friends or the people I'd train with or the people I'd go on to have romantic relationships with in my 20s. you often recreate what's familiar to you. And what was familiar to me was chaos and drama.
Yeah. But it's amazing that you reject. I mean, given, I imagine you say my homies were doing it with the booze, you know, we know the society we live in that is very soaked in alcohol. So, yes, you had this sort of physical activity that was lifting you up and making you feel good and had you connected to people. But still, it was quite a lot to reject that culture entirely. I mean, did you ever drink and get drunk not like the feeling of it in your body? Or was it really just, I am not doing this. I can see what this is doing for my dad and I'm not going there.
Yeah, no, I did experiment with alcohol and drugs. So while I initially rejected it, eventually I'd muck around with it once in a while. But it was very infrequently. We're talking a handful of times a year. And I last got proper hammered when I was 24 years old. And then I just resolved, I'm never going to get that drunk again because can I swear on your podcast?
Yeah, go.
Because I was an idiot and I puked up and got an alcohol sick, which wasn't common, but I did do that a few times through my youth. Then I intermittently would drink super sensibly, nursing a drink, you know, having water between drinks for a couple more years. And then I think I was in Chile. I'd gone to university in South America and had a few drinks at a New Year's celebration in Valparaiso, woke up the next day and decided, that's me. Not because I was hungover or I'd made any terrible life choice. I was just this doesn't really add to my life. And in fact, it takes away from it. So,
it took me till 40 to figure that out.
Yeah, I was 27. And
were you still hanging around people and socializing? And did you find that difficult
So back then, my ex-partner was a real heavy social drinker and a lot of my friends were really heavy social drinkers. In fact, most of them. But I also had, I suppose, what we'd call a protective factor in that I was part of a youth subculture called straight edge, where people choose to abstain from alcohol, drugs, smoking, and even promiscuous sex. It was a whole subculture that fell out of the American punk rock and hardcore scene in the 80s. And that really appealed to me. So I started listening to this aggressive sort of pissed off music with a countercultural message as a teenager. And that informed my thinking in my 20s and gave me a whole set of people that I could hang out with who didn't drink and didn't hassle you about it. Because as much as my friends who did drink were cool and I love them and we still chill to this day, there was a peer pressure to not to drink, you know, you still get all these tests about your masculinity, now you're a real man and, you know.
So you think that, but I'm interested in hearing, you know, this culture that we have with regards men in New Zealand and alcohol, and it is a part of expressing your masculinity and you're a good mate, you know, the spates thing, you're a mate with your spates. And, it's a real thing, right, for men?
Yeah, I'm writing a thesis. I'm writing a master's thesis on masculinity right now and risk-taking behavior and substance use is part and parcel of an acculturation into, you know, masculinity. And that's not just in Aotearoa New Zealand, that's across most of the Western world, if not all of it. And that's perpetuated through not just what our parents and our uncles and our family do and then our friendship circles do, but what our big companies promote as normal. You know, if you look at social media feeds, if you listen to the music that's, you know, popular on Spotify and iTunes and YouTube, if you go for a walk through any city and you're bombarded with billboards, it's all normalizing alcohol culture. And it actually takes a degree of, I suppose, critical analysis to look at that and be this is a drug that kills 5 million people globally a year and is responsible for all manner of social harm. And yet I wrote an article about this recently. No, why don't we cancel big alcohol? You know, we're in this moment in time where people are losing their careers for a joke they made 12 years ago on Twitter. And yet, social activists turn a blind eye to like huge multinational, you know, multi-billion dollar companies that sell a product which kills people who are primarily from working class black and brown neighborhoods.
It is mad.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's utterly mad. And once your eyes are open and you see it for what it is, it you actually cannot believe. But I just keep thinking this is a culture that's so deeply embedded. It really is going to take a big thing. But I do believe, you know, I always talk about this is the Titanic, right? Our drinking culture. Yeah. And it has to do this. But at the moment, I think it's just starting to shift. There's enough disruptors speaking. Even in the 10 years since I quit, there's more just being spoken about, more like that article, which I'll link to, by the way, in the post where I embed this video. There's more sort of coming out in mainstream media. There's more people openly talking about their relationship, their problems with alcohol, that we are starting to shift it. But I wanted to ask you, Richie, about, you talk about the harm, and we all know the harm that's being caused in our society from alcohol, whether it be, you know, hospital admissions or family harm stats, or even the way alcohol plays into things like our suicide stats, all of it. But what about those internal impacts that we don't see so much of, that internal, you know, damage that it does? And I obviously want to talk with you about men in particular. So yes, it's about mateship and what have you, but what's happening to men when they're constantly putting that drug in and dulling their true selves and how they deal with emotion and stuff?
I'm not sure if you're familiar, but like alcohol is present in most of the people who, perhaps not most, I think it's about 50 or 60% of people who have an autopsy after a suicide. So there are, yeah, you might want to pull that up and double check that. I don't want to be putting out like disinformation or misinformation, but it's a very high percentage of people who commit suicide have alcohol in their system at the time that they take their own life. Because alcohol turns off your frontal cortex, the part of your body that makes like rational, logical decisions. And if you're already in a dark place mentally and emotionally, you can act more impulsively because of the impact of alcohol, right? And so suddenly like killing yourself doesn't get like a rational filter to check that and you take your own life. I think more broadly, you know, we are a society that, while it's shifting, boys and men in particular are acculturated to not talk about our inner worlds. You are still, and it's shifting, but you are still shamed and made fun of and told you're soft and feminized in a culture which still diminishes femininity for being like vulnerable. And so a lot of guys don't do that, and yet they still carry around their discontent and their stress and their anger and their pain. And alcohol is a very easy, socially encouraged way of numbing those feelings down. But you carry all that stuff around you, eventually it's going to poison you, right?
It is.
I think that plays out in a lot of ways. You know, I think it plays out in car accidents. It's not that I think. Statistically, this is true. It plays out in car accidents. It plays out in criminal offending. Plays out in violence. Plays out in family violence. Plays out in sexual violence. You know, alcohol is the single most used drug to intentionally stupefy someone for the purposes of date rape. But we don't really talk about that. People, you know. So I think. Alcohol is a tool that manifests in really negative ways, and that intersects with, you know, the whole process of how we learn about being a man, right? If from a really young age you grow up dealing with your feelings, whether they're positive or negative, whether it's a celebration or whether it's grief through alcohol, you never really learn how to process what's going on inside of you. You never learn how to articulate your feelings. You don't learn how to communicate honestly. You don't learn how to
that's everything that you're describing. Me basically,
you don't get to regulate your emotions.
How can you develop these things? How can you possibly, when you are constantly altering your brain chemistry? For me it was daily. For a lot of people in New Zealand it's daily. But taking it away is painful, right? And you said at the start of this that people contact you almost daily wanting help. And we know that that those first, and most of our members, people watching this, are in those early stages. We know how hard it is. You take it away, you're not just dealing with cravings and how do I socialize and all of the rest of it. But I feel uncomfortable. I feel sad today. I feel angry today. I got an email that hurts. My loved one has died. There's a pandemic, you know, whatever. And you've got no coping mechanism. It's hard. So how do you talk to men that come to you about what to do about that? It's a big question, I know, but.
Can you, I'm sorry, someone keeps knocking on my door. Can you pause this for 1 second?
Yeah, let's pause.
Pause.
Richie, how are you? Good, thanks.
Okay, I've muted Richie because I don't actually know how to pause, so I'm going to keep recording and talking to you directly. So, yeah, I mean, most of our members at Living Sober are women. We know this, but we do have a growing number of men, and I know there'll be some of you watching. And I just think this is the really important stuff that we need to talk about, particularly for men, because as Richie said, it's harder for people to, for men maybe, to go to that place of emotional vulnerability where you have to open up and start accepting and embracing and learning to deal with your emotions in the raw. Here he comes.
Sorry.
No, that's all good. Right. I actually couldn't pause. So what I did was I muted you and then I just talked a bit. and now you're back. So
sorry, viewers. My neighbor kept knocking on my door. Apparently there's some bombing.
That's all good. Look, we're not highbrow here, trust me. Do you remember where we were?
Yeah, you were talking about dealing
how
with
how do men learn how to deal how with men- their stuff.
When alcohol's been taken away, I think that's a difficult question because, like you said, like it's often the key point of like socialization, right? You know, when I go give a talk to a rugby team or to schoolboys, I'm like, how do you ask people to hang out? And they say, do you want to catch up for a drink? Like it's so ubiquitous, it's part of our syntax now, it's part of the language that we use, you know? You know, catching up for a drink is what we consider the go-to way of hanging out, and when we don't have that, it can be hard. So
it's
I encourage
a fast track to bonding too, isn't it? You get that dopamine hit, you're instantly relaxed, you're kind of connecting on that level, and then it's like a fast track to it, but it's just not that kind of deeper. It's so cliched, authentic way of connecting.
Yeah, and infrequently. Yeah, I think there's nothing wrong with that infrequently, but like you said, for a lot of people, that's like a daily thing. They come home from a stressful day at work in a crazy and, you know, global environment, and they have a few drinks to like take the pressure down. But, you know, kids growing up watching that are getting conditioned to that sort of behavior. And then they'll generally go on to recreate that. There's a friend of mine, Peter Thorburn, who's a amazing drug and alcohol counselor, and he explained to me this concept of operant conditioning. You know, your operating environment like programs you for your own behaviors later in life. And if
operant conditioning,
yeah,
wow, okay,
let's check it out. He explains it like this. You should definitely look up Peter. He's an amazing dude. He's spoken at a few workshops that I've delivered, and he's awesome. But he talks about, you know, if you're a little kid, dad comes home, he's real pissed off, or mom, and they get to the fridge, crack a few drinks, and you see them like visibly relax, right? Eventually that kid will start having their own problems as a teenager. And how do you think they've been like socialized to deal with their emotions, like we're talking about, or their mental well-being, or their mental state? You know, alcohol is a go-to. And then obviously you have broader culture and normalizing that message day in and day out through entertainment and advertising. So how do you deal with that? Well, you know, I obviously, if you follow me online, I talk about building a lifestyle that you don't always need to escape from, right? And I know that sounds like a really privileged thing because many of us have economic stresses that mean that we do a lot of shit that we don't like for a lot of the time, whether that's long hours at jobs who we don't like, or not seeing our families enough, or not seeing our friends enough, all the things which are good for social cohesion and good mental health, you know, our broader environment is actually makes it hard to do, I would suggest. But that doesn't mean that we still can't put looking after our mental fitness at the forefront of how we live our lives. So I think all people need to actually put that at the first, like, it's like everyone's mental and physical and spiritual and familial health should be like at the forefront of their minds. Like, how we all live our lives needs to be radically redressed, I would say. I think we need to put eating well, sleeping more, being offline more, working out daily, whatever that workout looks like, first, and everything else second, because we have a crisis of anxiety, depression, over-medicalization, social fracturing, and alcohol and drugs are like a go-to, readily available way for addressing all of that stuff. And the only people who profit from that are big, big, big corporations who don't give a fuck about you.
And it doesn't actually really help in the long term.
It doesn't help.
It compounds and adds.
That's it. I never had a fist fight with a sober person as a young man, right?
Like, so how do you deal with stuff?
Go back to your 20s.
How did you deal with things when you were learning, when you were just new, you know, a teenager or in your 20s, you'd rejected this culture that was there and that you'd seen from your dad, but yet life is life, right? And stuff was tricky. Mm. How did you manage your emotions then?
Yeah, so I might, so probably not that, not as healthily as I do now. So this is all retrospective learning. In my 20s, I just was busy all the time. So I was a champion amateur kickboxer and I became a professional, you know, Muay Thai fighter. So that means I was in the gym twice a day, 6 days a week, watching what I ate. I played in shitty bands as a teenager. I went to university when I was 27 and finished at 31 whilst I was still fighting. So I always had a lot on.
Right.
I kind of kept, I guess, very strict boundaries in place and used busyness as a way of, in hindsight, maybe some form of emotional avoidance. But at the same time, in a very healthy way, it gave me the structure, discipline that I didn't get from like a childhood with healthy boundaries and healthy attachments, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
So it had its negatives in that if I look back at my romantic relationship through my 20s and even early 30s, I didn't know how to be properly vulnerable and intimate with people because I always had this barrier of structure that I couldn't deviate from.
Like tightly held,
Yeah, I had to be really tightly held. I needed everything to be strict. I was very strict. And I was also very angry. And that had a healthy catharsis through the musical scene I was involved in, which I was like always at concerts, whether here in New Zealand or in America or in Australia, listening to this really aggressive yet positive messaged music. And also I was in the gym every day working out my feelings.
Right, there's a lot going on there.
This my day was like this. Like, you know, I'd go to Thailand for like, you know, a month, 2 months. You know, like I'd leave my partner at home. I'm like, peace, I've got to go on this like spiritual journey.
Yeah.
Go running in the 40-degree heat, listening to like metal, smashing pads for an hour, sleep all day, do it again in the afternoon. Like, and I'm grateful for that because a lot of my friends got into like gangs or drugs or suicide or, you know, all the statistics. Although the sort of young people I deal with now, you know, I work with young people in services using like Muay Thai and stuff as a mentoring tool. I really see my younger self in them, you know. Yeah. So I'm really grateful for that. But at the same time, whilst I was making healthier choices, I wasn't always necessarily processing emotions.
Yeah.
But I did start going to therapy when I was about 24 or 25. So that gave me some insights. And it wasn't until I got divorced when I was 34, 35, that I went back to therapy because all that stuff that I had just kept a lid on through busyness, It wasn't there anymore, I'd broken up with I guess the first person who really made me feel seen, I suppose. And then I'd also retired from fighting because I was going through like a rough patch mentally, I suppose, in hindsight. So I had this big void. I was going through a divorce. I didn't have this single focus of combat sports anymore. And this big void sort of like emerged. But I didn't fill it with alcohol and drugs.
Right, you didn't.
I stayed sober and stayed true to that sort of self. But my mental health really took a dive. What got me through that was, I guess, a lot of late nights using Instagram excessively, too much dessert, and a lot of like kind of empty relationships. So it hasn't always been like this virtuous journey of clean living. You know, like you can, this is what I've found, this is what I've learned over the years, is that it doesn't have to be alcohol. It can be shopping, it can be food, it can be an excess of rigidity in your life, and it can be the inability to sit with yourself, and it's easy to like date or hook up with people.
Yeah,
all these things are like affect numbing tools, right? They take us away from ourselves, they stop us from really feeling hurt or stress or confusion or any of these sorts of things. And yeah, I guess in hindsight, I kind of, without knowing it, was always in some sort of relationship or another, but because I was hurt, and on some level, whoever I was dating was invariably hurt too, because we are like magnets. I don't know about you, but like, you know, I talk about this in other interviews I've done. Elaine de Botton does this wonderful talk called Why You Almost Will Always Marry the Wrong Person.
I'll link to that. I'll find it.
It's truly brilliant. It's truly brilliant.
What is it called?
Why You Almost Will Always Marry the Wrong Person.
Wow.
And he talks in very lighthearted but deeply insightful terms about how we find what's familiar to us. And if we have like some sort of like psychopathology, or we have some sort of mental health issues, or we're in we're in the habit of rescuing, you know, like someone like me who's not a heavy drinker but grew up with a heavy drinker in my family. I don't know if you're familiar with like family systems, alcoholism, or you've looked at like Al-Anon and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like that was me. Like I would always like be like, if you're like hot and beautiful and you got some issues going on and you're funny, we should totally have a relationship. and you know, we would trigger one another. And I've been in some wonderful relationships with people whose issues intersected with mine, but I've also been in some pretty chaotic ones. And it would be easy for me to say, well, they were crazy, they did the alcohol and the drugs and they had the personality sort of, but the fact of the matter is that I had my unresolved issues too, and we just fell into roles, you know. And it takes work and therapy and prolonged sobriety and sitting with your discomfort
and being honest with yourself. And that's obviously what happened with you. You had that little eye and that gritty phase when you got divorced and you were eating too much food and doing too much Instagram or whatever it was, that horrible gritty phase. But there was that little part of you that was going, this isn't right, this isn't right. Well, and I always say that's one of the things. You've got to listen to that little worried voice inside.
Well, I kind of got sick and, you know, like I'm sober, right? I've been sober for 15 years and never had a drinking problem, but I got sick and tired of being sick and tired. You don't have to be an alcoholic to feel like that. I got sick and tired of having my heart broken. I got sick and tired of trying to save people. I got sick and tired of trying to make sense of, why does this fucking keep happening? Like, what is wrong with me? And I had to go on a real journey to understand that. And I've read countless books and listened to podcasts and talked to people who are older than me, who might have been through some of those cycles. And
I love those people, don't you?
Oh, yo, some of the most insightful people on God's earth are people who have been through the shit, you know?
Yeah, and they're my
people. That's like my spiritual homeland. Like, if you're fucking from a white picket fence family, true story, I find it real hard to relate to you.
Yes. Like, you need to seek out those of us that have gone down and then up again. Because that's where the gold is. And the discomfort is kind of hard as hell, though, right? When you're there, it's hard as hell.
And it's interesting. Like, I was talking to, you know, my partner, Claire, and, you know, and sometimes I grow away from old friends as I move through different cycles, you know, like people who might still be stuck in that place that I was, or they haven't done their own healing. We kind of just don't resonate like we used to anymore. And you kind of, I think that's true of a lot of people in recovery circles, right? Like, if you're still hanging out with the people you always hang out with, chances are you're not going to like move forwards.
And it is one of the hard things we find our members often talk about, that sort of grief or that they feel when they get sober and they do start to drift away from the people that have given them so much comfort and connection. And we always say, look, hold on, it takes time, but you're likely to build up these wonderful new kind of different relationships that are more enriching ultimately, I've found anyway. But it can be that period of adjustment, which is why anyone who does it again is a hero, because it's so hard on so many levels, that shifting your life from one way of being to the other. But let it also be said, Richie, I mean, you do such great work now, you really do, and, you know, helping especially the men and the young men in this country, a lot of whom, you know, are disconnected or at least not given the opportunity to be fully, freely emotional. You're also in a relationship with an amazing woman who, you know, full disclosure, Claire Robbie, who I've done one of these with, and it's also going to be on the site. And you've got a baby on the way.
Yo, I know. Yeah, I have a baby on the way, which is quite the surprise. But so exciting. Yeah, I am excited because, you know, at the outset of this conversation, I was born into like a dysfunctional family history, and I'm very cognizant of that, and I'm very cognizant that my son won't be, because Claire and I have worked really hard on ourselves, and that allows us to work on our relationship together, and that means the son that we made gets to benefit from that, and he won't have to do the hard work that we've done.
He'll do his own hard work. Life will happen. It always does.
Life will happen, but I like to think that I have a bit of a head start, you know? I feel through my 30s, I lost a lot of time from achieving the goals that I had because I was dealing with unresolved issues, you know?
Do you think of it as lost time, though? Because I wonder whether that time is actually time well spent, because it now informs everything you do. That lived experience is valuable.
Yeah, that's a really good perspective, Lotta. Yeah, you're right. Like I gave this talk once, and I said the basic premise of the talk was like, all the hardest things that have ever happened are the best things that have ever happened to me. Because precisely what you said, like, if I'd not grown up visiting dad in rehab, or having the police come to my house, or any of that shit, I wouldn't be in the position to reach the young people, boys and girls, men and women, that I do now, because I'd be completely unrelatable.
Yeah.
And I like who I am, and my own idiosyncrasies have given me like a fucking real interesting life. Like, I've spent a huge amount of my time like traveling around the world, hanging out with like fucking rock stars and speaking on stages and like fighting on television and doing all this crazy shit, and like while, like, sometimes I'm like, it'll be good to be an accountant and own a house. like way less, way more boring, you know what I mean?
I can't imagine that.
Nah, me either. Like, next week I'm off to Melbourne to a heavy metal festival, heavy music festival, and I'm running like panel discussions on like mental health and fitness and shit, and like perhaps it's atypical and like can be like invoice sort of living, but it's meaningful, right?
Absolutely. And it really is helping. So kia kaha to you. And who you are as well, for what it's worth. And I thank you again for coming on this sobriety chat for our website. You know, we've got thousands and thousands of members. We get a lot of hits. And, you know, adding your voice to help us disrupt the status quo around alcohol and emotional stuff is just really valuable. So thank you.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you for being interested in talking with me, and thank you for your hard work. Like I really empathize with how hard it is, and I just really want to like mihi to you and acknowledge you for what you're doing. It's important.
Thank you, Richie. All right. Well, on that love fest note, bye-bye.
Yo, nice to talk with you.
See ya.
Bye.